I'm Ed Wissetti.
And I am from Valparaiso University in Indiana. And I kind of got lost out here in the West and made my way to Holden Village. And I'm just having a marvelous time after 1 week. Last week I was talking to the guests about Islam and Baha'i and Buddhism and one Indian group from southern Arizona, the Yankees, who are a Christian group and have a very interesting Easter liturgy. Our advice is that since there is not always a full turnover in the guests of the village, that we ought not to repeat sessions in a second week. So this week I have decided to pick up four sessions on what we call Indians. That is, the Indians of India first, the real ones. And that's tonight, Hinduism. And tomorrow night, I want to talk about the Hare Krishna people whom you meet in the airports sometimes, and try to help you see how they're tied in into Hinduism and some of the main things about their teachings. And also, briefly at least, transcendental meditation, which was a kind of sweeping movement in our country, especially in the late 60s and early 70s. Not quite so noticeable anymore. And then we take that big break for the 4th of July on Wednesday, and don't do any of the usual things. And on Thursday and Friday, I'm going to have my first chance to try to share with you people about some American Indian things, or Native American things, we really should call that. Some of their beliefs and attitudes. There on Thursday, I want to pick up the whole notion of person, as I believe that the Native Americans have a much more expanded concept of person than we do, and I would like to talk about that and illustrate it and try to explore a little bit what that might mean for Christians who pay attention to it. And then on Friday, I want to talk about certain things from the Black Elk tradition, especially the purification of the sweat lodge and the vision quest. It was just my privilege to begin, really, the studies of American Indians somewhat recently, so it will be my first chance to really begin to share that kind of thing with somebody, but I think we can do it properly. So tonight, let me get started right away. We have to be very prompt about ending, probably at 5 minutes till 8, don't we, in order to be fair with the Vespers time. I want to talk about Hinduism, but in order to do that, I need to set up some contrasts. And the first part of my presentation will be a study in contrasts. And here I want to contrast immanence and transcendence. Start with two big words right away. But perhaps most of you already have some acquaintance with those kind of words. That is, in religions of mankind, it is possible to notice whether a people emphasizes the divine reality as being within the very stuff of this world, within nature, most obviously, within the human self, and so forth, or whether they tend to emphasize that divinity lies within the divine and not at all within the created stuff. And that to take that to an extreme is certainly the notion of transcendence. It's interesting as we look at religions of mankind to see which of those two directions they lean in the way they respond to their world. Now, I would like to suggest that most of the primal religions, or as I would rather call them, traditional religions, and some people call them still primitive religions, that word has some problems. But African traditional religions, tribal religions of Africa, religions of the Native Americans here in this country, of New Guinea and of the Australian Aborigines and people of this sort, almost always we find among these peoples an emphasis upon the fact that the divine reality remains within the stuff of the creation. They seem to respond most fundamentally to the mystery of life itself. Where there is life, there is a cause, there is a power, there is the force of life, the mystery that brings life. And where is there life? Not just here where we see something alive and there where we see something alive, but it's in this food chain especially, isn't it? As we receive our life, I have my life from that which I take in, from my food, it becomes me, becomes my life. And so behind the source of food, which was not to be taken for granted that there would be any food at all, but behind the source of food there lies somehow the power that brings that life, that channels that life to me. So the ultimate food giver, food provider. So in hunting tribes, most of the time, this took the shape of a certain kind of symbolic figure that is usually called the master of animals, a kind of divine figure that was talked about in the mythologies as though it were an overgrown, let's say, buffalo. In this case, it's buffaloes. And a kind of mystical buffalo was maybe a little bit spiritualized and maybe pretty concrete, kind of sometimes one way and sometimes another. Sometimes this master of animals figure, as they would portray it, would be partly human and partly animal. So it might have the head and chest of a buffalo and legs and trunk like a man, something like this. But they would portray this being as somehow the divine reality that stands between human beings and life, their food supply. So you have the symbol of the divine presence right there in a master of animals. Or for the agriculturalists, people who learn to survive by planting, we have a proliferation of goddesses of the earth who are the force behind the growth of the plants that bring to us the life, or the spirits that are perhaps responsible for the growth of certain plants, like the corn spirits or the spirits of banana trees or whatever kind of thing. My point simply here is that the divine is experienced within the stuff of nature as human beings confront their lifeline. Where life comes, there is the great mystery. It becomes, in that way, a revelation of divine presence. Now, the same kind of thing can be talked about, not just about food, but about water. Since, especially people who had to carry every bucket of water that they had 8, 10, 12 miles and nurse it along for many days up for a large extended family, they knew what water meant in relation to life again. Water of life. The light. And the sun as bringer of life and light, knowledge, and all of this, warmth. Air, all of these things which are the absolute necessities for the mystery that there is life itself. It seems as though that primitive man is marveling that there could possibly be something instead of just nothing. Why is there life? And so it is never to be taken for granted. Now, it seems to be true that where that notion of immanence is so dominant, the divine experience within the stuff of nature, that we frequently will have an religious expressions that we have been accustomed to comfortably categorize as polytheism. That is, a people have a number of different sources of life, don't they? And a divine symbolic image is associated with each one of them, and so one of them is called the mother of the crops, and the other is called a master of animals, and the other is the Lord and the Son, or the Father of the Son. And the different So we get a kind of polytheistic, many deities is what the way it appears at least. Now I have learned to be suspicious of categorizing religions that way, because it's just kind of too simple, and I'm afraid sometimes it doesn't do justice to what they are really thinking. And if it doesn't, then we don't dare do it. It's not fair to understand them and deliberately allow ourselves to misunderstand them. So at least if we're going to use the word polytheism, as we see a number of different divine beings being talked about, prayed to, we have to do so very carefully. In such a religion where immanence is emphasized, the rhythms of the cosmos, cosmic rhythms, seem to provide the clues. That is, the seasons are, for instance, the rhythm of the seasons following each other become absolutely vital, don't they, as the bringers of life. So in the hunting societies where they did not yet plant, it was the seasons that governed where the herds would be at a different time of the year, and that meant where the people would nomadically move themselves in order to be near their food supply, where the berries were growing at a certain time of the year. So the cosmic rhythms, the rhythms of the seasons, or the rhythms of the moon, for that goes through its fast rhythm all the time, and that begins to say something to human beings. They see the rhythms of birth and life duration and death all around them, all the time, in the plants, in the animals, in the movement of the sun, in the moon, and in their own life. A kind of death and rebirth cycle always is before them and pounding away at their consciousness. And they come to understand their own existence as caught up in those same kinds of cosmic rhythms. So why should human beings be really any different from that of the rest of the cosmos, of which they are a part? So we find that human beings in their religious life, what we call their religious life, are participating with this cosmos ritually, we say. That is, they are performing rituals which enact, which dramatize the things that nature is doing. So if nature, for instance, is conceived as the Mesopotamians often conceived nature as the coming together of Father Sky and Mother Earth in a sexual union that brings forth life, then the ritual participation in that in the ancient Near East involved certain types of sacred prostitution, ceremonies of sacred sexual unions and things of that. And that made the prophets of Israel cluck their tongues kind of noisily because they didn't like the looks of that. But let me say it another way. When the spirits of the corn come to the Hopi Indians, when it's time for them to come a few weeks back, the people have a ceremony. And the Kachina dancers dance the presence of the corn spirits. And when they're doing that, it's really happening. They are ritually participating in the cosmic rhythms. And that is the human responsibility. That's the way humans remind themselves that they are a part of nature, that they are dependent upon it, and that they participate with nature in these holy cycles of life-bringing. In that kind of religious emphasis, we generally find that the most important understanding of time is the way time keeps coming back to its beginnings all the time. It always goes round and round, doesn't it? Birth, life, death, rebirth. Life, death, rebirth. And so, time then does not march on in an indefinite line, going somewhere, as though it were going somewhere, but rather time is to be understood in a cyclical way. Now that doesn't mean they don't understand that one year follows another and one generation follows another. They have all that language too. But what they find most important, most significant to their human existence is the recovery of the moment of creation, where things come back into being again. And that's where the ends are. I'm going too long on this, I can see. But that's immanence. That's the way things take shape, generally speaking, where a religion emphasizes this immanence. In contrast to that, perhaps a little bit easier for us to understand because it's closer to home, is an emphasis on transcendence. Here, that is, where the divine reality is beyond any other reality, where the creator is not really in that which he creates, but simply makes it, sets it apart, and cherishes it, but it is not him. And where that kind of emphasis comes, as it does in the first chapters of Genesis. The God, like the potter, creates the pot. It manifests his glorious intention and his majesty, majestic will and power, perhaps the creation does, but he is not his creation. And the two, creation and the creator, must not be confused. So that when that kind of emphasis is there, we call that transcendence. In the particular traditions that we are most acquainted with, Christianity and its mother religion, Judaism, and a sister religion, Islam, all three of which trace themselves back to Abraham and have their great prophets, we have a monotheism, that is, one God, the belief that there is one God and that that God is transcendent of his creation. In those religions, we have a lot of fuss about idolatry. Idolatry is frequently identified where the creation is worshipped instead of the creator. And sometimes it focuses upon the simple fact that there are images made. And so to avoid any appearance of idolatry in this monotheistic setting, oftentimes the people were forbidden to make an image of anything, like as in Islam, lest it would seem that what they were doing was worshiping that thing as having a divine nature in it. So idolatry is the definition of the great sin, really, in a monotheistic tradition. The message that comes, or revelation, I'll take the word revelation, whereas revelation of meaning in the religions of immanence, whereas there the revelation was simply in the rhythms of nature. They revealed to us the flow of life and meaning. Here, the revelation is in message, a message, and in historical events, in actions through which God is believed to be doing something and unfolding his will for his world. So we have a different understanding of how revelation goes. The emphasis here then is on a message that can be preached and proclaimed in the name of God by prophets who are really only spokesmen for God. And it is a message that focuses upon God acting in historical time. And here, instead of this circle being the prime source of meaning, we have the movement of time in a linear way as the source of meaning. For God has out here, it was believed from the beginning, a great telos, that is, an ending which has purpose and fulfillment. It's not just the end, as you see at the end of the movie, but it is the completion. And in God's plan is this great telos. All of history then moves toward that. So time takes on a very different meaning then in this kind of tradition than it does in a religion that emphasizes immanence. And that's a long way to get into Hinduism, but I think it's kind of essential to see that so that you might have a little more appreciative way of seeing what Hinduism is really doing. If there are points of clarification about what I've just said, and I think the implications of it could be talked about for many, many hours, but if there are points of clarification, I'd pick it up right now. Clear enough, okay, I think. All right, now, I want to speak first about Hinduism's view of the divine reality. That's why I did that whole setup. In Hinduism, I have suggested by my title, 300 Million Gods, Yet One, I've suggested that in some way or another, in spite of appearances, Hinduism is to be seen as focusing upon one divine reality. Now, I won't go into how that all came about, but I will talk about one of the earliest expressions of that oneness. Way back in about at least 1500 BC, in one of the hymns of the early Rig Veda, there was a hymn called the Hymn to Purusha. And Purusha here referred to, get one of these to write for me. Purusha refers to person, or kind of the divine person, the supreme person, the person who was the ultimate and alone at the beginning. And this little story about Purusha says that he was all things, existed before anything else was there. But then he desired to become this world. And he was sacrificed. Now, logically, we got a problem there. If he was the only thing that existed, then who could sacrifice him? And we might also ask, to whom could he be sacrificed? But the story invents sages and sadhus and holy men to do the sacrificing, just as do it in historical time. Stories can do marvelous things. Okay? So the Purusha is to be sacrificed. And then it goes on to say that out of that sacrifice of Purusha came forth all of the essential, most significant things in this world of human beings. Out of Purusha came the material world, that is, the mountains might be his backbone, the sky, the firmament is his head, the earth is his feet, and the atmosphere is his midsection, and the horizons are his ears. And so it would go through in the poem and show a correspondence between every aspect of material nature and this divine being who was being sacrificed, as though the divine reality is all together at one point, and now it becomes this world, moving out. The energy of the world is the divine being. Not only does he become that which is the material world, but he becomes that which is the non-material world as well. And so all of the 330 million, and of course that's just a number out of the blue, all of the gods and spirits of the world are, in fact, simply manifestations of that same one divine Purusha. And that hymn of creation goes then to show a view of Purusha's creation as immanence. For he has created a world where the divine reality is to be found in everything that exists. That's what why the story was made up, right? Because it was experienced in everything. Therefore, the story of creation says how it came to be in everything, through the sacrifice of Purusha. All right, then that poem goes on to say, though, and this is very significant, I think. It says, but all that existed after he had become this world, both material and non-material, was only one-fourth of him. The three-fourths is beyond. What's that trying to say? It's trying to say that there is indeed immanence that we have up here, that it is within, but at the same time, the whole universe of stuff that exists, when added together, is only but one-fourth of him. He is far beyond that. And so it tries to suggest both immanence and transcendence, and tries to take both of them very seriously. Well, I speak about karma in terms of the law of karma. But when I talk about law of karma now, or when India talks about law of karma, he's talking about something perhaps which it would help us to use the analogy of law of gravity. That is simply a built-in natural law of reality. So in the law of gravity, nobody's necessarily mad at me when I go splat after having jumped off of a five-story building or something like that. Or it is simply gravity that brought me down. So they would say the law of karma is also an impersonal law working in this world where the deeds of a person will always bring about a certain consequence. You know, what you sow, that you shall reap. Now, everybody believes that, to some extent at least, that we believe that our deeds bring forth consequences. You work hard in school where I teach, and in students who work very, very hard, the consequence of that might be a smiling professor at them and A's on their papers and da-da-da-da-da, a nice transcript and all that. If I walk out into a busy intersection, my karma, my action of walking out into a busy intersection, not paying any attention, it brings its result. I'm smacked. But where we differ, I suppose, in this, is that with India, is that we would suggest that when life has come to an end now, that is the end of the cause and effect sequence. India says this law, this impersonal law of cause and effect, karma, has an effect that runs across the line of death, and that's why we talk then about rebirth. So, my actions in this life, some of them have brought forth their consequence, haven't they? I got angry, I kicked hard at a stone, and I now am nursing a broken toe. And the consequence was there. Lots of your actions have brought forth. Actions, by the way, are also thoughts, emotions, attitudes. That's how subtle the notion of action should be. Because we're talking about a moral thing. But whenever I die, there will be endless actions of mine that will not yet have brought about their full consequence. And India would look upon those as the seeds of karma, which require that the Atman must come into life again in order to reap the consequences of deeds done in past lifetimes which had not yet brought their consequence. Want to run that around again? Is that good? You got it? All right. The deeds which I've done, some have not brought their consequences now, but it is a universal law that they must. Therefore, we can visualize it as though they are attached to Atman, to the true self. These deeds that are wrongful deeds, I guess we should say mostly, but I won't get it any more subtle than that right now. So that is the rule, the law in the universe that says there must be rebirth, and it also dictates what kind of rebirth it's going to be. For if my actions in this life have been in accord with the truth and moving in the direction of the true nature of this world, then I will come back in a better and better condition in future lifetimes. Perhaps even such a good condition that I may come to a kind of absolute knowledge of God somewhere along the line. But if on the other hand I, in this life, am morally sloppy about a lot of things, and that is if I do not live my life in the direction of the absolute truth, but instead live upon the lie of this psycho biological, historical self that always wants something, wants more and wants more. If I live that way, I will move, as it were, down the ladder of rebirths to less and less fortunate rebirths, even in the animal realm and the demon realm and things like this when you listen to the stories. So the point of it, of course, is simply that there is a moral responsibility built into the structures of a divine universe, and that it is inescapable, and that what we do, we shall reap the results of that. Now, there is for the soul, ideally, for the Atman, I should say here, there is for the Atman the possibility, however, of continuing to come to higher and higher births until the moment of release, a release from the rebirth cycle. That arrow that I'm drawing means that the whole historical cycle of birth and death, where cause and effect rule, that there is a possibility of breaking out of that into an eternal moment. And outside of that is the divine itself. For the divine embraces this world of things that we know, but it also is beyond this. And so if we were to attain the release, the liberation, we would find ourselves totally united with the divine reality and not come back to birth again. It's the way Hinduism would talk about that. So they call that, I've used the term release, and I think I'll let it stand at that. Now that already suggests something of my next point, the ultimate destiny of human beings. What is it that human beings can possibly come to, ideally? There really are two different strands for the answering of this. The one is, I'm going to have to call it by a name like this, a monistic answer, and the other is, I'm going to call it a dualistic answer. Now, let's see. Let me do the dualistic answer first. Here's the answer that aspect of Hinduism that says God is personal and worshiper is personal. And so the God loves me and I love and serve the God. And so a relationship, a kind of reaching out person to person, a relationship is established. And when I die in devotional service to the deity, I and deity being the two, divine reality and human reality being the two is here, that they remain separate realities, and I go to the paradise of God and enjoy His companionship forever, His love forever. Okay? Dualistic answer picks up on the notion of God as personal and presents the picture of relationship which lasts beyond death and saves me from coming back into this life. Another answer that India gives to this question belongs, I said, to the monistic vision. Monistic suggests that all reality is one. Material reality, spiritual reality, divine is one with me. I am one with the divine. I am one with you. I am one with all things. There are no separate selves. There is no individuality. All is one. That's what the monistic means. Now, within that tradition of India, the suggestion of what happens, what is the ultimate destiny of a human being? Well, it is release from this rebirth cycle to become, now this is where it gets tough to picture it, to become one in the great ocean of divine reality, to simply like a drop of water being joined to the great divine ocean. That would be one way to try to say it. Don't like that very much probably, because What you're hanging on to is that individual selfhood. Will this personality, with this kind of, will that last eternally? But the monistic vision is out to destroy that notion of clinging to an individual selfhood and talks about oneness with all. So there really are two separate strands of Hindu thought and many different groups within each that give you those two types of answers. Now, finally then, I would simply say that I think those are probably the fundamental things that tie all of Hinduism together. Now, with those things as a basis, there is still room for an almost infinite variety of things that can be labeled Hindu. But there is rebirth, there is a kind of immanence of the divine in everything, there is a spirit soul, a divine self within, which is in trouble, which is caught in a rebirth cycle, but which can be released. All of Hinduism in some way buys that. But that's the problem of humanity to be solved. Whether it gets solved in a dualistic, personal, devotional kind of relationship to the divine, or whether it gets solved in terms of meditation, where I discover the true self and within, the divine within, and think in terms of the universal it, rather than thou. Well, that's a lot in a hurry, but it will give us a place to attach our little portrait tomorrow night of who these Krishna consciousness people are in the airports and in the streets, and where a couple other things came from. Now, questions?
Where does the sacred cow come out of that? Is that one of the failed processes?
There are a lot of different answers to that question, and that suggests to me that the answer just kind of changes down through history. The earliest Aryans in India, who really are at the beginning of this religious tradition that I'm unfolding, were pastoralist people. And for them, cows were as important as buffaloes were to the Plains Indians. That is, everything about the cow was the life of people and the life of the culture. And so they were really honored that way. They were the wealth, and there's something of that that came down in. But I think that also, that also got combined with this notion of immanence, the divine reality present within all the animals. And so this very important animal kind of became a special case in point. And to respect that animal was to respect the very principle that the divine is in all living beings, all sentient beings. They use that an awful lot in that tradition. I don't know if that needs to be taken any further, but that seems to be where it goes in parts of India where monkeys, for instance, are sacred rats. They have temples that are just overrun where the people bring offerings that literally feed the rats and monkeys and things like this, where that principle has been elevated to a very high status. People are kind of preoccupied with it. Other questions at this point? Comments? Yes.
There are some celebrities, and I'm thinking particularly of Shirley MacLaine, who's become very involved in reincarnation and seeking other selves through a medium. I wonder if you could address the Christian viewpoint on reincarnation, and because those who believe in it have very, very strong beliefs and are publishing.
Well, let's see. How do I approach that? First of all, in the Eastern traditions, it is as much a taken for, it's axiomatic, it's as much taken for granted in their Eastern traditions that there is rebirth, as it is in the Western tradition that somehow there is an individual lifetime. It's simply, we don't challenge that. It just seems so obvious. That is, most people don't challenge it. If one is to try to ask which of those points of view, from an objective standpoint, which of those points of view about human existence is most reasonable, I don't know how you're going to come out. It's going to depend on your prior prejudices, because if you look at the world as human beings a part of this cyclical process all the time, birth, death, then it'd be very logical to see it that way. But the Hebrews, stand at the beginning of our biblical tradition, didn't see time primarily in this cyclical way. They didn't see the divine significance in the constant return to what this moment of newness. They saw this line in which God guiding and ruling, bringing all humanity toward his purposes. And that set up a kind of one beginning and one telos, one fulfilling end. Huh? And that notion seems to have been accompanied on there by the notion of a single conception, a single lifetime, a judgment, and from there a kind of some sort of eternal destiny, but not a coming back into this life. So what can I say? In my estimation, there's no way to say that reincarnation is a Christian idea. It's something I think that they met a lot on their way in many parts of the Greek world. But maybe there's some other folks who might add something to that. People in here who might prepare to comment.
The appeal of that sidebook is that you have justice. Everything works itself out right. I think that appeals to a lot of people. There are no loose ends. When the cycle is done, the person is released, it's finished. The disadvantage I feel is, and I don't know how much Hinduism, because I haven't studied it that much, how much it allows for interruption of a whole cycle by forgiveness. I know there are Hindu doctrines of grace. And so we could conceive of the cycle being broken by forgiveness.
Yeah.
And you don't have to work it all out.
In this tradition, they can. In this tradition, I guess not really, strictly speaking. I need to free you, but I'll take one more question and then we have to move forward.
In the rebirth cycle, when a person does die, what kind of a funeral do they go through, and is cremation part of their beliefs?
Well, the Atman is released in a ceremonial, in the ceremony of the funeral. The Atman leaves the body here. The name of that place, I forget. It closes slowly for a child. That's where it leaves. That's where it leaves the body in the funeral rite. What was that?
Yeah, okay. But even though they might come back again into life, they'll still cremate the body?
Sure. The body, it is the true self, the spirit self, that comes back all the time. The body is just good for feeding daisies. Okay, for now we'll...
pick up some of these other things.
So what, I'm just like, I'm all of a sudden, yes, I know we've been talking about that for 2 years. Higher being, there's higher power, and it never says God, it never says Christ, but it's just inner truth. I've never understood it.
Well, hang in there with it.
Oh, yeah.
Be patient.
That's what I'm trying.
Do you have outlines that you have of prepared to have we're touring around this stuff when we get home to picking up the tapes of many of the talks you've had during work times.
Yeah.
And picking up the
I have some outlines like this right here. Here is the sketch of what I did tonight except for the last part.
I think it'd be a lot easier to listen to the tape with an outline in front.
I could loan you this sheet and let you Xerox it.
Now's the wrong time to do that, but maybe sometime during the day tomorrow.
If I give it to you now and you don't fold it up in your pocket.
Guard it with your life.
Okay.
Would you like to get a candy bar? I mean,
you do
that? Well, I kind of bought it
with all these things.
I know.
A little sweetness I hold in there.
Thank you very much, Dad.
See you again tomorrow.
This part of your question is not necessarily. I've been in India, but my job is not to learn all this.